Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD To The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indie Radio, we are going to find out how to beat Bobby Flay, and we'll hear about local wineries winning in a major international competition. First, we'll talk with Chef Steve Oakley of Oakley's Bistro in Indianapolis about his recent appearance on the Food Network show Beat Bobby Flay. He'll tell us how that all came about and what it was like on set. Then we'll learn about the Indie International Wine Competition that was held last week at Purdue University when we talk with Christian Butzke, Professor of Enology at Purdue and Chief Judge at the Indy International. Then we'll head to two local wineries to talk about how they did at the competition. First, we'll talk with Jeff Durm of Buck Creek Winery and then Blake Loudermilk of Easley Winery. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Always fun to see local faces on national TV, and we've seen several people in Indy's food community find their way to Food Network shows. But just how does that happen? Indianapolis chef Steve Oakley appeared on the Food Network show Beat Bobby Flay recently and won, but to get there took more work than you might think. I talked with the chef recently about the time and preparation involved to get on the show and what happened once he was there.
So tell me about the process of getting on Beat Bobby Flay. How did it all start? Did they reach out? Do you reach out?
They reached out probably about a year and a half ago.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was set up to, you know, then you go through a process, an interview process. There's probably four or five Skype interviews. There's recipes. You got to, I mean, it's a long process. It's not a an hour interview, and then you
and then you're
then you're done.
Right?
Yeah, there's probably at least 20 to 30 hours
of talking
and recipe development, sending things in, and pictures. And
what did they ask you? What did they want to know about you and your food?
Well, I think they're really searching for an idea or a thought or a different angle to what they already have done. You know, so as the process went on, it was it became more and more detailed and in depth as you know my life, the restaurant life.
So they want to know all that background information.
All that background, everything from your family life to restaurant life, where you've been, what you're doing, what's going on, you know, and then you submit all these recipes.
Because, you know, you're just making one dish on there against Bobby Flay.
One dish. And ironically, besides the 10 wardrobes that you have to submit. different types of clothes and so forth. So it's very specific to what their needs are, you know.
Right.
You can't be wearing anything logoed and so forth
reasons.
After submitting dishes that I thought about, like, what would I challenge them with?
Right.
You know, things like my grandma's pierogi or, you know, duck a la orange or different things. Because, I'm a fan of the show. I watch the show a lot.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so I submitted those. And they come back and they say, those are all really cool things, but what's this shrimp corn dog you do?
Oh, no, like, from your menu,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, from our menu and from, obviously, pictures on Facebook.
Right.
Because they take over all your social media, look at all that stuff.
Oh, do they really?
Uh-huh.
So they're really looking.
They're really looking into it and background checks on you and all that kind of stuff. So.
Oh, my gosh. I guess they don't want, you know, they want a bad guy on the show, right?
No, they don't want that. So as they dug deeper, they're like, "What are these corn dogs? They seem to be a fan favorite
and they
popular.
Are.
They are. They are." And I said, "I'm thinking to myself as a chef that's worked in 5-star restaurants and had a restaurant. I'm like,
right?
I don't want to be known for shrimp corn dog on national television, but They thought it was a great idea. It fit the theme of Midwestern Chef.
All right, the whole corn dog kind of thing, right?
And then no guarantees of winning, but it had a good story. And the story was, always going to the fair growing up, whether it's here in Indianapolis or in the northern part of the state that I grew up in. It kind of fit the theme. So they're
okay,
like,
I'm seeing it.
Yeah,
right?
They're like, this is a great dish, but you can't just put a shrimp on a stick and...
And batter it
and go. And even though the batter's homemade with fresh corn grated into it, they said, you need to do something else. And I'm thinking, oh, boy, what else can I do? So
right.
I started playing around with just making the own shrimp sausage just to resemble it,
Sure.
And after a few test trials and came up with it, submitted it again.
Oh, my gosh.
And submitted more pictures of my family, my grandparents, and so forth. They said, okay. And they said, well, we'll be back in touch with you. It's pretty short and sweet with them,
Oh, is it? Once they decide?
Once they decide. And like I said, there's no guarantees, but they have to have a plan if that's your dish if you're going forward after the first round. So
right. So I guess they had to ask all this of the other guy, too.
Exactly. Exactly. So, wow. I don't even know what Bobby's dish was, but Bobby was he's a great person. He came off on TV like, a crazy rock and roll guy, which he is, but he was probably more nervous than I was.
Was he not? Now, how was that? I mean, do you have much interaction with him when you're taping?
We had about an hour and a half before we got out on the set. They take you through the set. They show you everything. They explain every ingredient that's on the set.
So you see everything. So you know what's there.
You know what's there. Yeah, they make sure that you know what is... a chive. They point out everything.
Do they really?
Oh, yeah. Every spice, everything on the shelf.
Look, here's nutmeg.
Yeah. And my biggest worry was, am I going to get a piece of kitchen equipment that I haven't really, because different KitchenAids or food processors are different.
And you don't want to be the guy that can't get the thing to work.
Yeah. I was that guy because the one they had is a little bit different than what we're used to in a commercial kitchen. And, so you go through that whole process of seeing it, but he was a very interesting fellow, very successful in Nashville. Has a couple restaurants that he does some chef work for.
Right.
He's really a barbecue guy.
The other guy.
Bobby. Yep. So nice guy, and you go out, you compete. They reveal this secret ingredient, and when they reveal the ingredient, I'm thinking, I haven't cooked this in a long time.
When I tell people what it was.
Yeah, so it was a top round of beef. And I'm thinking to myself, goodness, this is something that takes, 4, 5, 6 hours to do it right.
Right, right.
Slow and low.
But you don't have the time, right?
You don't have the time. So he reveals the ingredient, and you break for just about a minute to reset cameras and angles and things like that. And I'm trying to think of a dish. And it was like I never cooked before. It's like
is
my first time ever walking into anything, like a new career. And I'm looking at all these ingredients and going, I have no idea what I'm going to do.
Oh, my gosh. The pressure. Yeah. I can't imagine.
And I'm terrified and I'm thinking.
Oh, really? Really?
Yeah, I really was. This is probably the most nerve-wracking part of the whole show was the first
that
round.
That first round challenge where you're up against the other guy.
When you're up against him. And so they start doing the countdown, 10 seconds, 9, and I'm looking. And I see quail eggs, and I'm like, okay. And steak and eggs came to mind.
Okay.
So I thought, well, I'll do a tartare, and I'll do some warm quail eggs and figure out the rest as I go.
Oh, my goodness.
So we get things rolling. And my idea was to grind the top round of beef instead of dicing it because it's pretty tough. And so I go and get the KitchenAid processor. Put the attachment on there, turn it on, and it shoots across the table.
Oh, no.
I go to reach for it. I almost knocked the food processor off the table. I grab that. Put it back on real quick. I start trying to put the top round through. Nothing's coming through. I'm like, at that point, I turn around, knock the olive oil bottle off the table.
Oh, my goodness.
Breaks on the floor. You know, and you keep going. This
cooking, you can't stop.
No,
right?
You don't stop. The cooking is it's for real. It's whatever you do. I mean,
wow.
So there's no like cut. Hey, let's try
like,
that
let's
again.
Let's try it. Right. Well, no, let's pick up that bottle. And
let's pick it up and do it.
So,
so finally, I'm like, just okay, Steve, just gather yourself. I'm like, really? I could feel the sweat running down my back.
Wow.
You know, there's probably 40 people staring at you besides the crowd.
There's the crowd all around, right? And then there's people on set?
There's people on the set in front of you that you really don't see. And cameras are as close as to your nose that you don't see on TV. And I'm like, just gather your thoughts and, you know, you can do this.
So you got through that first challenge, and they liked it. So that's how you get to be up against Bobby Flay.
Yep, I got through the first challenge, and surprisingly, in the first run, they're like, afterwards, she's like, you need to make sure you season your stuff a little bit more. And I'm like, if people only knew, I said, we season pretty hard here, you know?
Right.
And so they were very nice. The judges were great. You know, you get ready, they reset the...
All right, this is Alex Guarnaccelli.
Bobby
Flay's girlfriend, right?
Yep.
So that's interesting,
her
interesting
first time,
judges.
Yeah, interesting judges. Her first time on the show. So I think she was a little nervous beforehand. We get to the secret ingredient, and you're standing there in the middle of the room, and they got this camera just whipping around your head, because they're like, just stay still for a few minutes. We have to get camera shots, you know? So it's a process. And then you reveal your secret ingredient, and I think the look on his face was
and it was good. So
priceless.
When you said you guys said we're going to make the seafood corn dog,
right.
I think he was a little surprised and taken aback.
He was quite taken aback, but.
I don't think you've seen a seafood corn dog on one of those shows before.
I don't think you probably ever will again. But, you know, I mean, here's an Iron Chef guy. He's got to be able to figure this out, right?
Sure.
I mean, that's when you're thinking about a dish to present him or to come across him. I'm like, you know, how do you beat this guy? And
well, I don't know. His seafood corn dog didn't look all that good. I just, you know, you had it all over him on the seafood corn dog thing.
Yeah. At one point, I walked over, and you know, he had a sauce that was burning.
Oh,
and,
that's right.
Yeah, so he burned his tangerine glaze or whatever he was making. You know, just it was friendly. Competitive.
Was it friendly? Is he a nice guy?
Very cool guy. You know, I mean, I think he gets a bad rap sometimes. You know, we all do as chefs, I guess. I mean, people don't like me, but that, you know, I'm a nice guy. So, but he's fantastic. I mean, the hospitality there, the people on the set, you know, the whole experience was, you know, it was life changing. It's,
Is it really so? Is it a big thing to go on there and do that?
It is. You know, it's a really big deal. And since the show, it's been a crazy. You know, it's just been a lot of great things going on, and just real happy about the whole experience. But the notoriety it's come to the restaurant, hopefully going to help for Indianapolis. You know, we're all out there throwing a little piece in there to get a star in Indiana here
right.
Somewhere. You know, I mean, you know, there's a lot going on here. It's a lot of cool stuff, a lot of great chefs.
We've been talking with Chef Steve Oakley of Oakley's Bistro in Indianapolis. For more information on the chef, check out oakleysbistro.com. States has been the largest consumer of wine for a while now, and we've heard a lot about the millennial generation pushing interest in wine even further. But the way we find out about wines has changed in recent years. There's less emphasis on glossy magazines and much more on social media, which is why I was posting a lot last week from the Indy International Wine Competition, one of the country's largest competitions, and one that takes place each year at Purdue University. I was happy to be there last week judging at the competition, which gets about 2,000 entries from all over the world. Christian Butsky is a professor in the Oenology program at Purdue and the chief judge at the Indy International. I sat down with him last week during a break in the judging to find out more about the value of wine competitions, his own background, and the importance of winning a medal at the Indy International.
Getting an independent opinion on wines, that's where wine competitions came in, a little bit like the Olympic Games. You know, that's how we give away, you know, bronze, silver, gold medals. You want to find out who is the best and who is really good, and you want to see all this. And you do that every now and then. But then again, this competition was founded 26 years ago, before the internet, before people had email, before social media, and it filled, again, a void between glossy magazines, wine books, articles you would read in an in-flat magazine, or just going into the wine shop or listening to what a sommelier recommends. So you would have something you... In the olden days, it would be a brochure that you look at, and you look up which wines won, and then you would go out and try to find those wines. Nowadays, the results of the Indy are being used on the winery's social media. They tweet about winning a trophy, or they post on Facebook which wine won a medal, and that allows them to promote the wines. It allows them to raise the price if there's more demand. But it also, and I'm a former winemaker, and as a winemaker have won many of those medals, it's reassurance that you're doing a good job, much like winning a medal at the Olympics. You know, that is great. You win something, you're really happy. You think, oh, I'm doing something good, because otherwise, other than maybe sales numbers, you usually don't get that reassurance if you're a winemaker. People write articles about it and all that. But this is a nice way to really send in your entire portfolio of wines and get some feedback from those folks here, the 50 judges that I have this year that are really quite representative of the general public.
Now, tell me a little bit about your background and how you came to be running the Indy International.
Now, I have spent my entire career in the American wine industry. I used to be on the faculty in the Department of Viticulture and Oenology at UC Davis, and there was responsible for the entire state of California and the extension, the technology transfer work that we did between the university and the winemakers in all of California. I started my career relatively young, and after I worked in California for 10 years, I felt the need to actually become a practitioner, and so I became a professional winemaker for a number of years, was director of winemaking out east at a winery, and then Purdue called me up and asked me if I wanted to come back into academia. My predecessor, Dr. Dick Vine, had retired, and he had started the competition here, taken it over as a small event that was held at the Indiana State Fair, and build it up from his days when he was the wine consultant for American Airlines. And many wineries send wines here to Purdue to him to be evaluated for first and business class wine lists. And so the competition grew over the years, became really an international event, just like this year where we have, I think it's 16 different countries entering from all around the wine world, and so because of that, it became part of the academic program of our extension program here at Purdue, one of the major research universities in the country. And so when I took it over in 2005, I saw an opportunity here to not just use the competition in the old-fashioned way of just promoting medal wins, but really using it as an educational tool. We bring Indiana winemakers here to have them judge, either as professional judges or judges in training, so they can taste all those different wines from around the world, from their neighboring states, so they see what is being popular right now, what other people are making. They're training their palates, becoming more sensitive to desirable characters, sometimes to flaws. So you just broaden your horizons in regard to different styles of wines that are made.
So it's an educational tool for the department and the university, as well as a means of rewarding wine.
Yes, wines. So it's a promotional tool. So the Purdue Wine Grape team, which organizes the event, is an integrated team. We are doing viticulture, so we're looking at grape growing. I'm the production person, really, educating about winemaking. But we also have a marketing specialist. So we're going really from grape to glass, which is the motto of the Purdue Wine Grape team, looking at marketing, sales, promotion opportunities too for the Indiana wine industry, but as the Indy serves really the national, the global wine industry, to make wine more approachable for consumers, make it less intimidating by, again, giving some objective results and giving people less of a fear when they see a big list of wines when they walk into a restaurant or if they walk into a grocery store and they stand in front of this wall of wines and have to make a quick decision of what they should buy for the evening or if they go to a party. So using the tool to educate winemakers, to reward them too, to educate consumers about the wines that are out there, and also many wineries using it kind of as a glimpse into the future of the business. People send their newly made wines here, their new wine styles, just to kind of test the waters of what people want. The American consumer is changing their preferences quite regularly. The U.S., as you know, is the largest consumer of wines in the world and has been now for a number of years. So what we drink influences the production practices really around the world.
Now, how many countries, you mentioned before, how many countries have submitted wines here, and how many bottles are you judging?
We have, I believe it's 16 different countries that have entered this year. So every relevant country in the world of wine has entered, including some kind of newcomers. So anywhere from Finland to Colombia, you know, a lot of countries, non-traditional countries, let's say, are trying their hand in making wine today. But
have
about
states,
2,000, right? 2,000 wines, 37 different U.S. states. Of course, there's wine industry in almost every state now, or in every state from Hawaii to Alaska to Maine to Florida, and so we see a lot of wines made around the country, a lot of different grape varieties, lots of different styles that are very different from, let's say, a traditional Mediterranean, you know, Italian dry red wine or a dry French white wine. So we see a lot of things that reflect Americans being more interested in wine, and sometimes that might mean it's a sweet Concord wine that tastes more like a kind of fortified Welsh's grape juice, but is extremely popular because you like it, people like the flavors, the fruitiness of it, and you can't argue with good, well-selling wines. You know, people make a business out of producing those wines. We have more than 90 little wineries here in Indiana right now. There are more than 8,000, I believe, now little family wineries across the United States. And despite the consolidation that we have seen in the U.S. wine industry, there are a lot of little family businesses that are doing quite well economically because the agritourism that comes with wine, the jazz concerts, the weddings, the all the different little things that surround the wine industry have really often elevated rural communities. In particular, you see a lot of wineries on old little main streets and in little towns that are really bringing new business in. Restaurants are evolving around them, and so I think we're really proud that we have contributed to that renaissance of small town Indiana communities here, where the wineries are really a focus of the communal life now, and people enjoy having the opportunity to have a picnic on a weekend or a social gathering, and they don't have to fly out to California necessarily or travel abroad. So that's part of what this does.
So the interest in wine, does it continue to grow? Are we seeing continued growth? I mean, I know we are we drink the most wine, mm-hmm. in the U.S., but are we seeing growing interest, especially among the millennial generation? Mm-hmm.
So the wine consumption, per capita wine consumption in the U.S. has very gently increased over the last few decades, but maybe only by 1% a year. But of course, the population has grown quite dramatically, and even though the population has grown, it's not evenly distributed. So it's a relatively small group of people that drink wine on a regular basis. But that percentage of people that are drinking wine has grown over the years, and so people have become more interested. Millennials, students graduating from Purdue, for example, now are becoming more interested in wine. Of course, they're also interested in craft brewing, they're interested in artisan distilleries, and so that certainly is seeing a renaissance as well. But altogether, because of the wine experiences that people can have in their local communities now, wine is just on the map. It just wasn't on the map. Even when I came here 11 years ago, we had maybe 30 wineries. Now we have 90. When the Purdue Wine Grape Team started, we had, I believe, 9 wineries. 26 years ago, and again, now it's 10 times as many. So the economic impact that wine has here in Indiana now is about $100 million, multiple billions if you look at it nationwide. And that's non-subsidized true agriculture. People are really farming. They're creating a value-added product that's different from corn and dairy and some other traditional crops. So we're, again, quite proud in contributing to the creation of this really local economic dynamo that gives people's jobs and creates taxes, part of which our extension program here is paid too, so I think it really helps and is helping us as members of a land grant university to really improve the livelihoods of the local community, and that's part of what a wine competition can do as well.
We've been talking with Christian Butzke of Purdue University and the Indy International Wine Competition. To find out more about the competition and to see a list of all the winners, go to indieinternational.org. Maybe you've seen the grapes growing along Interstate 74 just south of Indianapolis and wondered who would plant a vineyard alongside a highway. Well, the answer to that question is Jeff Durham of Buck Creek Winery, and that highway location was all part of the plan. He started planting grapes 25 years ago, opened the winery in 2006, and has been very successful at the Indy International Wine Competition, which just took place last week. The winery was just named Small Farm Winery of the Year and also had the Dessert Wine of the Year. Jeff got the chance to judge at the competition last week, and I wanted to hear what he thought about judging and to find out more about growing grapes here in Marion County, right by the highway.
Well, we started our winery, the vineyard we planted 25 years ago. For about 13 years, we grew the grapes, expanded the vineyard in size, sold grapes to other wineries. We made wine as amateurs on the side and eventually opened the winery 11 years ago. Built the winery, decided I retired from my other job, and here we are.
Now, people probably saw over the years, I know I did, saw the grapevines growing just right alongside the highway on 74.
Yeah, that was kind of a business plan that we had. We knew that if people could see the vineyard, you know, a lot of people that have wineries around Indiana, it's grandfather's old farmhouse, it's 20 miles, 10 miles, 5 miles off the interstate. It's great because, that land is free. It means a lot to them. But we wanted, because we didn't have that availability, we wanted to go ahead and find the best location we could. I had to stay in Marion County because of my job. We found a spot right next to the interstate with exit each, 1 mile each way, and knew if we could just put the vines out there, they could see it and they would stop. And as long as our wine was good and we were friendly, we would do well.
So being right here beside the highway has worked out.
It's been great. We've tried all kinds of forms of advertisement, and the one that we found to be the most effective is we've got actually three billboards on the interstate now, and about half of our business is from local folks that know about us in the area, and then the other half is from people that are traveling.
Oh, so that's nice. So you get
the wine, and they make their annual stops, it works out really well.
Well, talk a little bit about the craft of making wine and how you learned to do that. Were you self-taught? Do you have a background in this?
Well, I was pretty much self-taught. I visited some wineries in Ohio 25 years ago, fell in love with the idea of having a winery. There were a beautiful winery with 4 or 5 acres, really nice wines, right in the middle of Ohio. And I said, if they can do it in the middle of Ohio, we can do it in Indiana. So I looked for land. Again, this looked like the perfect location inside of Marion County, and just purchased the land, took some time to get a variance, zoning issues, planted the vineyard, and it's gone really well.
Now, the idea of planting a vineyard right here, where you're probably closer to corn and soybean fields than anything else, What did the neighbors think, when you started tilling up the land and you're going to plant grapevines?
Well, when we actually had to get a variance, like I mentioned. There were two remonstrators that lived right in this area, right down the street from us. And I think a few people thought maybe we're going to have a smoke bilging factory, or there'd be people driving drunk and crashing into trees. And they didn't understand exactly what it was all about. But now those two groups that remonstrated, 11 years ago are now coming in and bringing their families and friends and talking about their winery, their local winery. So it all worked out really well.
So you've become a local winery. You've become the winery, for people in the area. How has reaction been? Did the wider community embrace a winery here, right off the highway?
Yeah, I really believe that several people came in over the years and they were like, we drove by there for a couple years and we couldn't figure out what you were doing. We didn't know whether it was blueberries or what you were doing, and we just couldn't believe it was going to be a vineyard. And I think people are proud of the fact that they have a local winery in the area. And as well, we do music events that are free almost every Saturday in the summer. They've become a really great a way for the community in the area to come out. We have a food truck. For example, last weekend, I think on Saturday we had 400 or 500 people. On Sunday we had 300 or 400 people out here with their lawn chairs, playing cornhole with their dogs, with their kids, running around. And we had really good music, and people really enjoyed it. And I think it's becoming a nice little spot for people in the area to go and enjoy their Saturdays.
So tell me a little bit about the recent Indy International Wine Competition that you participated in, both as a judge, and then you also had wines entered.
Yes, it was a really great experience for us, for me, myself, and the winery. I was a judge this year. Of course, everything is blind. You don't know what you're tasting. You can't identify your own wine. But it was an unbelievably great experience for me. I got to talk to a lot of people in the industry that I normally wouldn't get to, and really the the judging aspect was very intriguing and very exciting. Really enjoyed it, and our wines did really well this year. We ended up with 17 medals. One of our wines ended up being dessert wine of the year, one of 5 categories out of 2,000 wines. So one of the 5 wines that was voted wine of the year, dessert wine of the year, and that was the second year in a row that wine, it's a Vidal Blanc ice wine, has won that award. And then really unbelievably fantastic news is we were awarded Small Farm Winery of the Year, which made us very proud. We felt very blessed. We've been wanting to, and we've been competing and been close for several years and getting that award, and it was just very exciting to actually receive that award.
Now, tell me a little bit about the judging itself. I got to participate this year, too. Fascinating, challenging. What was it like for you as a winemaker?
You know, it was a really good experience. Learned a lot about how other wines of the same grape, how they're put together, what they taste like. You know, of course, we're not actually drinking the wine. We're looking at the color. We're smelling the wine, checking the aromas, and then we put it in our mouths and we spit it out.
That is kind of interesting. You talk about, you know, you judge 120 wines in a day, but you're really not drinking them at all.
No, you're not. You're not. I mean, you do absorb a little bit, but you're really not drinking the wines. So that aspect was very different for me as well, because that's not my typical way to analyze wines, because there's, you know, a little bit more to it than that. But you have to do that. There was only 50 judges and 2,000 wines. You know, it was such a great experience, and I learned so much from the judges around me. They had years of experience. This was, you know, my first year to do the judging in that style, and it was a tremendous experience. And to have our winery do so well in the competition, it was glorious.
Now, tell me a little bit about the wines you entered. They almost all of them medaled, right?
We ended up with 3 double gold medals, 3 gold medals, 10 silver medals, and 1 bronze medal. Only one wine did not win a medal, and we were thrilled. And what they do is they have a formula that they look at as to the how many wines you entered. Did you enter enough wines? What was the awards given to those wines, and they decide who is going to be wine of the year, or excuse me, winery of the year. And it was fantastic. We had a double gold for a red blend that we have that's barrel aged for 2 years. It was voted best vinifera blend in that class, which was very exciting for us, because you have all the entries from California, from around the world. And we're not known as a dry red country, so that was extremely exciting. And my son, Joseph, actually developed a blend on that. So for a young 26-year-old, it was exciting for him, being a young winemaker, eventually stepping into dad's shoes. It's a great motivator for him, and I was very excited for him.
So it is a big competition, and it is an international competition. 37 states, 15 foreign countries participating in this. So you're not just up against local or even U.S. wines. This was a big deal to go up against wines from around the world.
It was a big deal. It was a great experience. We had judges from Austria, judges from around the country, and these were true professionals. And it was humbling for me, and I'm sure for you as well, to experience that. And very excited. One of our wines, the ice wine, the Vidal Blanc ice wine, voted wine of the year. Super excited for that.
We've been talking with winemaker Jeff Durham of Buck Creek Winery in Indianapolis. For more information on their award-winning wines, go to buckcreekwinery.com. Indiana wineries, and there are more than 90 of them now, are located in a rural setting, tucked into a barn or amid rows of grapevines. But Easley Winery is an urban winery. It opened in 1974 on College Avenue in downtown Indianapolis, and the Easley family has been making wine there ever since, and winning plenty of awards along the way. We've talked with owners Mark and Meredith Easley before here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. But this past week, I stopped in at the winery to talk with Blake Loudermilk, brand manager at Easley Enterprises. She was a judge at the Indy International Wine Competition at Purdue University last week, and I wanted to get her take on the experience, see how their wines fared in the competition, and find out what's new at Easley Winery.
So Easley ended this year's competition with 3 golds, 1 silver, and 5 bronze medals, which was really exciting. And, of course, Traminette, our 2015 vintage, took a gold. Our Reggae White, which is a Moscato blend now, took a gold as well. And then our new No Opposition Cabernet Sauvignon, which you see there behind you in the red, is our... is also a gold medal winner. So we were thrilled, especially with the cab being brand new. It was only bottled a few months ago. So having a young wine like that win a gold medal was really exciting. We think it's only going to get better with age.
Now, tell me a little bit about your participation in the Indy International, judging and with, you know, entering wines and that sort of thing.
Sure. So I started at Easley in 2014, and shortly after I started, I kind of took over the management of entering our wines into competitions. And we enter anywhere from 10 to 15 competitions a year, depending on, you know, timing and what we have available to enter. But the Indy's always a great competition for us. We always do well. Our wines always do well. We always get excited about it. So I'm the one who enters our wines. And then for the last 2 years, 2015 and 2016, I was a judge in training. So you get to sit at the table, you get to taste the wines, you get to, you know, tell them what you think that medal would be for that wine. And it doesn't necessarily count, obviously, but at least you get a sense of where your judgment would fall compared to the other people at your panel. And that was really helpful. So for 2 years I did that, and then this year they invited me to be an actual judge. And I was so excited because I do a lot of paperwork. I sit at a desk a lot these days. So to get out and taste wines and learn new things was just so amazing.
Now, it's a very big, very prestigious competition. I think we've said here today that there were 37 states represented, 15 countries. So how is it putting your wines up against wines from around the world?
It's so exciting because you see, obviously, so many different things coming from different parts of the world. And we enter things like a Cabernet Sauvignon, you know, and cab comes from all over the world. So you know that it's being judged against worldwide cabs. And I think that's another reason we were so excited that the No Opposition Cabernet Sauvignon won a gold this year. On the other hand, we do enter things like Traminette, where it's mostly a Midwest varietal. So to compare our Traminette versus all these other Traminettes from not just Indiana but other states is really exciting as well. I actually think that the Traminette of the year, the best of class Traminette this year, came from a Missouri winery, which was really exciting. But of course, there's always the Indiana Traminette of the year, Indiana wine of the year. And it's so nice that the competition takes that into account and separates those wines out just to see amongst each other, you know, how everybody does. And Traminette's always a big one because almost everyone in the state makes a Traminette. So it's really fun to see, you know, whose Traminettes are really excelling.
Well, now tell me a little bit about yours. It's our state wine, right?
It is. Signature Grape of Indiana. We had a large campaign for the grape a few years ago that was actually led by the Purdue Wine and Grape Council. It really got the knowledge about the grape out there. And I think Indiana residents who are at all involved in the wine industry in the state, they now know that they should be able to go to most Indiana wineries and try a Traminette, which could work for or against the winery, depending on whether or not they make one, of course. But some of the ones that we've seen come out of the Indiana wineries have been, yeah, amazing. Like I said, our Traminette, our 2014, was Wine of the Year at the Indiana International. So, I mean, it beat out every other wine that was entered, and we were so excited about that.
Now, that is a big deal. I mean, beating out all the other wines that were entered, 2,000 wines.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that was probably definitely the highest award of the competition, and we were thrilled to be able to get that. I believe the year before, our Traminette was White Wine of the Year, and like I said, I want to say our Traminette has won a gold medal for the last 5 or 6 years straight, if not a higher award.
Now, that's pretty awesome, and yet I'm not sure that people realize that Indiana wines really do stack up in competition with wines from around the world.
Absolutely. I mean, outside of Traminette, obviously, which is the go-to one that we always talk about, but we do also make a Bordeaux-style red blend here. It's called I Think Red Blend. It's Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot. And we entered that in a competition, not the Indy International, but it won best of class at a California competition. And obviously at that competition, you're really up against a lot of California cabs, or red blends, I should say. So to win best of class in a California competition like that, I think people need to start taking another look at Indiana wines and what we're capable of.
And I think that that's been the concern that we, the thinking might go, we really can't grow the top quality grapes, or we really don't make the top quality wine. But that's not true.
Absolutely. And there is a lot of, the grapes have to be grown in Indiana, that kind of idea, for it to be, truly an Indiana wine. But there are a lot of great grapes coming out of Michigan and, out of New York. They're not that far away, but it's really about what the winemaker does with those grapes that's so impressive. And we've seen some really amazing vinifera wines come out of Indiana wineries. Maybe the grapes weren't grown super close by, but it's what they did with those grapes. And we're really impressed with what these winemakers are able to do. Our winemaker has been here for 16 years now, and I think he's really mastered. Obviously, our Reggae wines are our big sellers, and they are selling like crazy. We almost can't keep up with the growth around here on the marketing side, but production is steaming away on those, and we're so happy that we have a winemaker who's able to capture the sweet palate of Indiana drinkers and serve it in a fun package. People are excited to buy it. It's a good price point. That's definitely our winning wines.
Well, now tell me a little bit about that sweet palate. We talk a lot about that. We talk a lot about how, Hoosiers have a sweet palate, or, Midwesterners have a sweet palate. But, they also say that about Southerners or people, honestly, from around the country. So is it really a negative?
I wouldn't say that it's a negative by any means. I personally find, I believe that a lot of times it's more difficult to make a sweet wine than it is to make a dry wine. It has to be balanced. That's key. It's not just sugar water that we're looking for here. It needs to be a high-quality, balanced wine, and that's what we really excel at here. We pride ourselves in premium sweet wines. The sweet palate that we refer to a lot of times, I think, has a lot to do with what we are brought up on. In the Midwest, we tend to grow up with a lot of, the fruit punch, the Hawaiian punch, the Coca-Cola, the Mountain Dew. So our palates are trained to like that sweet flavor. But I know a lot of dry drinkers in Indiana as well who can still appreciate a sweet wine for being a well-done wine.
And I think that's what you do in judging, isn't it? Is you're looking for what is a good example of whatever category it is. So you had to judge all sorts of things. Tell me a little bit about some of the judging.
Absolutely. So we were all over the board. I wish I had my flight list in front of me just so I could refer back to it. But we did everything from red vinifera down to white hybrid blends to fruit wines to flavored wines, really anything you can think of. And we had some really interesting flights. I had a fruit and flavored wine category, and it was fascinating. There was probably 11 different wines. And even though some panels might struggle with that because overall they were very sweet, I really enjoyed it because even though they were all sweet, you could still tell which wines had been really well done in terms of balance. You're looking for that acidity, not just an overpowering sweetness. And I got a lot of that. There were a couple of wines that I wish I knew what they were, and I would love to go buy them. Obviously I don't know what I was tasting.
Because it is a blind tasting. You have no idea. So even if you, entered wines from Easley Winery, you didn't know when your wines, where they would be or who would judge them or anything like that, right?
Absolutely. Because I know I definitely entered some wines into categories that I was judging, but with so many entries, there's no way to know if your wine is in that flight in front of you. And obviously there's more than one panel tasting each of those categories anyway. Yes, I have no idea if I tasted any of our wines, but hopefully if I did, I gave them a gold. We'll never know, but I am.
Tell me a little bit about what's going on right now at the winery.
Sure. So at the winery, our downtown Indianapolis location, and I do, as far as I know, we are the only downtown winery now. Of course, we used to have New Day, but they've switched pretty much over exclusively to Meads. Love New Day, though. But yes, so we are right downtown. We don't have that rural, you know, vines out back kind of look to us. We've got parking lots and skyscrapers around us. So
you are a city winery.
We absolutely are. And an urban winery is really interesting in terms of the marketing you can do with it. That's a lot of where our No Opposition brand came from. It's very rugged, very bold. Very ambitious, kind of. It's very, very urban, so we're excited about that. But yeah, so at the winery, we actually every Saturday have Groovin' in the Garden, which is our live music series. It's free. It's from 2 to 5 p.m. Usually the weather works in our favor. Unfortunately, if it rains, we usually get just rained out. But we have a great turnout for that. We do tours and tastings every weekend. And yeah, we have a lot of people come through here on a Saturday. It's really impressive. I'm actually working in the tasting room this Saturday, so I'm excited to see what my first Groovin' of the Year is going to be like.
Is there anything new happening at Easley? Anything we can look forward to or things you might want to mention?
Sure. So we've had a lot of infrastructure improvements around here lately. We just installed a new bottling line that is doubling our capacity. So we can now bottle twice as much in the same amount of time, which is amazing. And the other thing that bottling line allowed us to do was a different size package. So we are now doing 1.5 liter, which is two of what you would consider a normal size wine bottle. We can do those bottles. And we are very excited to announce that just this week we released our first ever wine-based cocktail. So we just released a Reggae Margarita. It is wine-based, but it tastes just like your traditional margarita. I'm a big margarita fan, and I love it, so I give it a full endorsement. But we're really excited to see what happens with the Reggae brand, and just there's so many opportunities within that brand for new things that we can do. And I'm excited maybe to enter that into the competition next year. I'm not sure what category it'll go under yet, but I think it would do well. So the things like that, just constant innovation is what you're going to probably be seeing out of Easley for the next few years.
We've been talking with Blake Loudermilk of Easley Winery in Indianapolis. For more information on the winery, including tours and tasting hours, go to easleywinery.com. I'm Jolene Katzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, and D-Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning into our show today, and thanks also to our guests, Chef Steve Oakley of Oakley's Bistro in Indianapolis, Christian Butzke of Purdue University and the Indy International Wine Competition, Jeff Durham of Buck Creek Winery, and Blake Loudermilk of Easley Winery. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indy Radio. Eat, Drink, Indy Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com. Eat local. Drink local. Eat, drink, indie.